Now we're ready. Thank you.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the February 28, 2024 Quality Committee of the Board, otherwise known as the QPSC. Madam Clerk, roll call, please.
Trustee Bouquet.
Here.
Trustee Garrett.
Here.
Trustee Stein.
Here.
We have a quorum. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Clerk. With that, I tend to always open the Quality Committee with the purpose of the QPSC. From the original guidelines, the QPSC is established to provide oversight and leadership for medical staff credentialing, review of organizational policies, and monitoring of organizational quality assurance, performance improvement, and safety programs. The QPSC is charged with continuing the practice of direct communication with medical staff leaders on issues of clinical operations and patient care. And so that's our charter. With that, can we go to any public comment, if any, Madam Clerk?
No one has reached out to me.
Okay. Last chance. Anyone for the two people who are in the room? Okay. All right. With that, let's go to item A. 10 minutes have been allocated. This is the chair's comments. There's an article, but before I do this, I want to give, I think this is remiss of me. I blew it off last time, or maybe I can't remember. I want to give welcome to our new Associate Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Beth Mahler, who's right there. Everyone on the left side of the screen right there. Dr. Mahler joins us. Dr. Mahler and I knew each other way, way back when. Beth, what was that, 15, 16 years ago? Beth is smart and super capable. She'll have oversight. Her primary site of oversight will be Alameda Hospital and San Leandro Hospital. While take this moment to congratulate Dr. Torna Bene, because she gets to round out her associate chief medical officer team. So to remind everyone, reporting to Dr. Torna Bene, our Dr. Mahler, who will have oversight over Alameda and San Leandro. There's Dr. Andrea Wu, who's Dr. Mahler's an internist. Dr. Andrea Wu is an emergency physician, and her primary purview will be oversight at Highland Hospital. And then there's Dr. Portia Mack, who's a pediatrician who has oversight over ambulatory. Am I getting it right, Dr. Torna Bene?
Yeah.
So congratulations to Dr. Torna Bene. She finally gets her team.
2 years in the making.
2 years in the making. So with that, the article selected, I want to give a little bit of context for this article. So at one of our recent Board of Trustees meetings, I was commenting on some of our quality data. I thought I was striving to be balanced and display the losses and some of the wins. However, it became obvious to me that one of my valued colleagues, who I respect deeply, thought maybe I was a bit pessimistic on the state of quality here at AHS. That obviously inspired some introspection on being balanced, and that's how I sort of, that was my journey to landing at this article. This article is entitled An Asset-Based Quality Improvement Tool for Healthcare Organizations, Cultivating Organization-Wide Quality Improvement and Healthcare Professional Engagement. Kind of a long article, but it comes from, you know, the venerable Joint Commission Journal on Quality and Patient Safety, so it must be saying something. Here's sort of the Reader's Digest version of this article. Most, if not all, healthcare organizations are biased towards what these authors call deficit-based quality and safety improvement work. It makes sense. In short, they focus on adverse events, what went wrong. The intent is good to drive quality and safety, and it comes from a good place. The benefits are solving specific problems and fulfilling regulatory requirements, which is probably a primary driver. But it goes forth and talks about the unintended consequences, which include negative sentiment from the frontline healthcare professionals. This can result in disengagement, sometimes underreporting of adverse events because it's not a great experience for. I bet you nearly every physician has undergone some version of this, and it never feels good. And the so-called second victim of the mob. So this article describes one medical center. It's actually Banner Health, which is based out of largely based out of Arizona. And what they are trying to do is give greater balance to the positives in quality work. And actually, they developed a system to sort of formally report it and use it, and they call this asset-based quality improvement. So really to talk about good things which have happened in the organization and actually try to extract the learning lesson from that. I think we do variation. I think every medical center does a variation of this, but I thought it was fascinating that they chose to sort of systematize it and put it into their kind of quality routine. And now I'll shut up. That was my entree. I'll open it up to Dr. Tornabene, our Chief Quality Officer, Anna Torres, any trustees, anyone?
Sure. First of all, I'll say I just love this. I love this article. And for me, it started kind of crossing over into, you know, what are we trying to do, for example, with our annual culture safety survey as well, like to kind of capture sometimes not just the negatives, but the assets of the organization, the positives. And so actually before starting this evening, Anna and I were just talking about what would it mean if, like, how could we build something like this into our system so that we're not just doing the potential for not just doing root cause analyses on adverse events or near misses, but actually excellent outcomes. Like,
yeah.
What happens if there's a truly excellent case? And there's so much to learn from that. And can we do a root cause analysis for excellence as well? And then, you know, kind of share out those learnings. So I'm really excited about the possibilities here. And I do completely agree with the framework that it has to be built into a system. Otherwise, just, you know, there's so many emails I think that all of us get celebrating people, but how do we make that systematic so actually we could potentially track in front?
Yeah, I thought it was fascinating. Trustees?
I, back in the 90s, was it, spent a year in this Council for Excellence in Government program, benchmarking these different businesses and places, and it was built around this book that was written then called In Search of Excellence.
Yeah.
It was called the book. And so that was a theme then, this idea is let's study the successful stuff as opposed to the stuff. And they studied successful companies in the books, like Bayer was one of them, Johnson & Johnson. And I think it's a kind of a good idea, but when I read the article, and I've been to Banner, it seemed to me like it would be the administrative investment is a potential issue. So think about something simple like automobile accidents. The person that has an automobile accident usually has it because they didn't follow the rules of the road, their vehicle wasn't right, they weren't paying attention, they were sick, something like that. The person has a good driving record. There isn't something about them that you can really reproduce. It's probably that they followed all the rules. So every week we come here and we have all these procedures that we talk about. And if you follow the procedures, you do well. So the way to make this work in my mind, it was a little bit different than what they did, is you'd have to look at excellence like over time, mm-hmm. not a particular case, but say you have, you know, three physicians in a particular specialty that have a similar patient base and one of them is, you know, over time is getting better results. Then you'd have to say, well, maybe there's something wrong with our procedures or somebody's doing something, you know, and then you could kind of find that. Because definitely finding the right things to do and systematizing those, I'm all for that.
Yeah.
But the way they did it seemed a little cumbersome. I mean, listening to it as an outsider, it does seem like we have an awful lot of overhead, you know, and maybe that's just the way, you know, hospitals and medical systems have to work. Adding more overhead is a challenge.
Yes, sir.
So that was my only concern.
Yeah, great comment.
Hmm. I'll take both of those. I think Trustee Sain has a very good point that things have to be longitudinal, that single incidents and single interventions may not give a fuller picture. The administrative burden, I think Dr. Tornabene's comment about celebrating the, and as the article mentioned, celebrating the accomplishments, doing root cause, I had not thought of that. I hadn't framed my mind in root cause analysis of good things that for success. That was a wonderful aha moment, thank you. And then, you know, as I did read the article, I marked it up considerably. I'm always concerned about the amazing amount that we expect from our providers to be the best providers possible, do your quality goals, but here, come and let's do more administrative work. And I'll point out in their summary, they say, to be clear, our goal was not to replace deficit-based quality improvement, such as peer review and incident reporting. Rather, this complements. What they're saying is, you got to do now three things. So, and then the paragraph before that says, another pitfall is frontline healthcare providers' limited time for non-clinical data entry. So they say that, and then they say, well, we're going to add to that. So I would say that whatever system is created cannot add to the burden of providers who are already stressed and already under tremendous pressure. it needs to complement it in a way that accomplishes the goals we've talked about, but doesn't add to the administrative burden.
That's right. Anyone else? All right, thanks for that. Sir, yes?
I would just say I was intrigued by this article, and you've heard Mark Kratzky and I talk about and working from an abundance mindset and moving away from a scarcity mindset. So this was kind of analogous to that for me, thematically, because moving from the adverse event reporting model and, you know, supplanting that with one that, you know, we look at, you know, what are the strengths and how do we enhance and help with that aspect of it. So I was just appreciative of the change in perspective that this article offered.
Thanks, sir. And I'll close by thanking my friend and colleague for calling me out for doing like that. With that, I'll close out item A. We're as of right now, we're 1 minute ahead of time. We're going to item B. 10 minutes have been allocated to the consent agenda. Trustees, you have items B1, B2, B3, and B4 before you. Any items you feel need to be pulled for discussion? Sir?
No.
With that, may I entertain a motion to approve the consent agenda in its entirety?
So moved.
Second.
Madam Clerk?
Trustee Bouquet.
Yes.
And Trustee Garrett.
Yes.
And Trustee Stein.
Yes.
The motion passes.
Thank you, Madam Clerk. We'll try to not let you talk very much. With that, we will go to item C. This is sort of one of the core pieces of this meeting, where we hear directly from our medical staff leaders. This evening we have Dr. Lana Lee, the chief of our medical staff for Alameda Health System, which includes San Leandro and Highland. We have Dr. Abid Moganam. I don't know if Dr. Moganam's in the room, I can't see, but he's from our San Leandro Hospital Leadership Committee. And of course, Dr. Nikki Joshi, who's our chief of the medical staff for Alameda Hospital. Madam Clerk, would you mind putting that executive summary up? We're trying that new practice of looking at the executive summary for a minute or two together.
All right, 1 second.
And if you'll go up just a little bit. Okay, and now you can start scrolling down to strategic planning key points. So I'm just giving everyone, as everyone might know, or I report last time, I'm asking all presenters to develop an executive summary. So this will help us hopefully grease the wheels of this meeting and give us a little bit more content here. We'll give everyone about 30 more seconds to read this. Thank you, Rana. You can scroll down to next page. And scroll a little halfway up. There we go. Is everyone good enough for a starter as we go in? Dr. Lana Lee's in the room this evening. Let's, Dr. Lee, welcome.
Thank you.
Why don't we open up with you?
Sure. If Dr. B. Moganam's on the call, I actually would prefer if he go first. But
He's not.
Okay.
He was in surgery at 4 p.m., so I'm not sure he would make it. But thank you. Thank you, Board of Trustees, for allowing me to speak tonight. Dr. Joshi is at the America's Essential Hospitals Fellowship Session in Washington, D.C., so she's unable to attend. So I'll give her a portion of the report as well. So at the Alameda Hospital MEC on February 16, 2024, Dr. Borneo and Dr. Rizzolfo provided education to the Alameda Hospital MEC, and they will continue to use this data that was provided during this session and continue other sessions that will inform the decision related to matters around patient throughput and Alameda Hospital strategy. In terms of the AHS and Alameda Hospital combined medical staff, during that meeting, there was a discussion around St. Rose Hospital, and the MEC expressed a lot of desire as well as hopes to work with the executive leadership as we explore our relationship and consider our proposal for St. Rose Hospital. We hope to better understand the current state of clinical services at St. Rose Hospital and participate in the discussion and planning. Also, the departments of anesthesia and pediatrics, if you scroll down our report, there are report department summaries. They gave their department presentations and their summaries are in your report. I did invite Dr. Lang tonight, who was a chair of our anesthesia department, to come and give us a quick summary of her department report.
Good evening, Dr. Lang.
Hi there. Apologies, I'm calling you from the Stanford campus. There might be some background noise, so apologies for that. Well, first of all, thank you for letting me share a brief summary of the department priorities and activities for anesthesia. We've had a focus on patient care and working towards improving safety and quality for the system. Safety is of particular importance in the field of anesthesia. There's a history of efforts to improve the safety of anesthesia healthcare just overall in general through different engineering and architecture building. We've organized the work into two buckets, at least in my mind. The first I'm going to describe as the culture and environment within our department and more broadly in the organization. And the second is instruction and process. So for the first bucket, what I'm talking about is developing and an environment where we can openly share, we learn from each other, we work as a team, we recognize that mistakes happen, but we use them as opportunities to improve in a meaningful way. There's conversation, trust, and respect. And that's been a huge endeavor that we're still kind of gonna be on the journey on for quite some time. The second being structure and process. Dr. Lee's summary sort of describes some of the details around that I shared. But my focus has been creating concrete forums for discussion, processes to address the identified issues. We've been trying to empower the group to identify issues and to be part of the solution. More structurally, creating processes for reporting valid data so that, you know, how do we know what we know? And do we know of all the events and incidences that we need to know about? For fixing things, that's still in its, I think, brainstorming phase, and a process for following up, which would come after. We're still, you know, as I'm alluding to, in the early phases of trying to recognize goals, being able to measure ourselves, addressing and analyzing the problems, and celebrating the wins. Examples of the above are in the slide deck that I gave to MEC. But these are things as concrete examples are case conferences, our quality review, committee restructuring, building a leadership team within our department, building new programs like the pre-op clinic, which we call the POET clinic. And then really the one that I'm most excited about is creating clinical guidelines for our system to define standards of care. I'm sorry, I'm on the undergrad campus, so the students are around me. Just wanted to call up the are being done in a vacuum. They've been really collaborative efforts, especially for the anesthesia department, where we are, you know, always working alongside our colleagues in other departments. So this is just a summary. I just wanted to express some of the progress, but really just trying to describe my, you know, my recognition and commitment to safety being the floor and quality being the ceiling. And we have, you know, a lot of work to do. And I think we're all, here to do that work. So thank you so much for allowing me these minutes, and I'm happy to take any comments or questions.
Thank you, Dr. Lang. Trustees, any questions of Dr. Lang, our chair of anesthesiology? Thank you, Dr. Lang.
Done as well.
Got
Trustees, any questions? And did you say Dr. Joshi is not available?
She's not available.
Got it. So it's just you. It's not.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'll open it up for any trustees. I have some questions. So on your executive summary, key point number one, it said enhancing clinical staff to support patient quality, and then there are bullet points: mitigating burnout, improving patient throughput, reduce length of stay, anticipation of growth. Can you sort of expound on that statement?
I think the discussion revolved around, having out-of-grid provider staffing in order to ensure patient safety and quality. Some departments were talking about being overworked or having to work above what they're contracted to do in order to fulfill all the essential services that exist. And so I believe that the discussion really evolved around having adequate staffing, both provider and nursing, in order to support all those efforts.
Were there any actionable items or requests out of that discussion?
I don't recall. I mean, okay. I'm sure that Dr. Tornabene might have heard about like individual department FTE requests or.
Dr. Tornabene, is this just broadly speaking?
I believe so.
Okay.
I was on the last NBC.
Okay.
But,
got it.
Indeed. Dr. Pelzhorn and I have been going through certainly in AHMG and then with our other physician leaders in ambulatory looking at staffing in each department and specialty.
Got it. Dr. Lee, another question which you've commented on before. One of your last bullet points was AHS Medical Staff Search Committee is by department chair recruitment. So for our other trustees, there are actually 11 clinical departments. So so five of them are in search of a leader. So can you expound on this with regard to search committees, anticipated hirings, scenarios in which what we maybe got in this circumstance?
Sure. I can start with ambulatory care and preventive medicine. I believe last year we assigned an interim chair for that department, Dr. Shrimlatha Piranam. You guys heard her when she came to present at QPSC. And we are looking forward to starting the search for creating the committee in search of that department leader. For the Department of Imaging and Radiology, the committee has completed their work. There is a candidate who is due to arrive. I think they're in credentialing currently and hopefully to start by the end of the summer, June.
So that's actually a hire.
Mm-hmm.
So, got it.
For the Department of OMG, there have been candidates identified. I believe interviews are being set up for those candidates in March. For the Department of Pathology and Laboratory Medicine, as you all know, Dr. Ng is retiring for the end of the year. She holds the position of chair of the department as well as other regulatory positions at AHS. The medical staff is engaged right now in search of the chair position. And I believe Dr. Tornabene and Dr. Pelzhorn are also working on the regulatory positions that she holds. The committee has been formed, and we are putting together a job description.
Big shoes.
Yes, very big shoes.
For our trustees, Dr. Ng has been a fixture here at Alameda Health System for, I think, about 20 years, maybe a little bit longer. I think she came in 2003 or 4 or 5. And she's really sort of been the beating heart of both pathology and equally important, or perhaps more important, laboratory medicine. Dr. Tornabene, what stat did she? A couple of million tests run every year.
Uh-huh.
She helped, set up our whole COVID testing system, which was, she is very detail oriented. So big shoes to fill.
She's also been a medical staff leader and really a guiding light for many, many physicians.
Yeah. Yeah. So we'll definitely celebrate her when I think she's estimating in the fall. Is that right?
October. Yeah.
Okay.
And for the Department of Psychiatry, the committee has a job description now. They've been interviewed several candidates now. I don't believe that they have anybody that they've heavily liked, but I believe they're continuing to recruit and do interviews.
Okay. Thank you for that. Trustees, any other questions for Dr. Lee? Thank you for your report.
Thank you.
So with that, we will close out item C, and we are a little bit ahead of time, which is nice. This is the part of the evening where we go into quality reports. So we'll be hearing in item D1 from Anna Torres, our chief of quality, and then item D2, Richard Espinoza, who's our CAO for post-acute. And perhaps a new routine, let's read the executive summary. These are drafted by the presenters, and hopefully we'll, again, grease the wheels for the presentation so that the data's up for you. We'll just, you know, spend 30 seconds, 45 seconds reading this together. Rana, would you please scroll down to halfway? Thank you. Awesome. Thank you, Rana. Will you scroll down to the TNM dashboard, which is right below this, and then S-size it. Good evening, Ms. Forrest.
Good evening.
So thank you for submitting your executive summary. Pretty clean. I think we have a good understanding of that. So open it up for you to report however you'd like to us.
Sure. So we know we've got two metrics in the green. Those are the two access ones. I want to talk a little bit about the harm metric, which if you look up there, we will likely not meet the goal. It doesn't tell the full story, so there's some good news under that harm metric. So our CLABSI, which are central line associated bloodstream infections, and our CAUTI, catheter associated UTIs, we have seen a decrease in those infections. So, and in fact, our bloodstream infection rate, catheter-associated bloodstream infection rate, we've gone almost 5 months without a CLABSI. So that is actually huge for us. The CAUTI infections have decreased, although we've not been successful in eliminating them quite yet. And I do want to take some time to just talk about our PI team that's working on the CLABSI and CAUTI. I think, you know, we started out by talking about positive things and maybe things that we can celebrate. I think that special one is one of them. Dr. Chen, who's one of our physician champions, is here. But for instance, at Monday's meeting, we had four physicians there: nursing, education, and quality. So it's really a team effort. It takes a village, and I think that that team is doing amazing things and moving these numbers. In the 2 years that I've been here, that's the longest we've been without a CLABSI. Now, last year, we had a period of about 3 months without a CLABSI, but I think it's really, it's positive news because it shows us what we can do when we all band together. So really positive news there. Where we are seeing issues with the harm are related to the behavior events, falls, and skin issues. When we look at the harm rate, under patient safety, it's those same areas. And when we look at the reportable event, again, we see skin issues, and we didn't see falls this time, but they seem to be the same type of event. So we do have PI teams working on those areas. So there are two metrics where we didn't meet. Harm is one of them, and we won't meet it. The other is the up-to-date health screening, where we have not met, but there is a presentation later today, and they've got good news. So next.
Rana, can you scroll down just a little bit, just to remind us all, to the next page? Preventative screening is one of our True North metric items.
Right.
Where is it?
So it's third from the top.
Third from the top. And we're going to be hearing an expansive talk on that this evening.
Yeah, so and no, that's probably one that will change to green next month. So they've done some work there too. All the other metrics are really have not met goal, but they are improving they're better than baseline. Whether we'll meet at the end of the fiscal year, maybe not, but they're moving in the right direction.
Thank you for that report. Trustees, any questions of Ms. Torres? I have a question. It might be taxed at Dr. Tornabene. Dr. Tornabene, in my recollection, 4 months is the longest that I recall,
yeah.
Like, period. So, Ms. Torres, have you been here for 2 years?
2 years.
It's only been 2 years?
Yeah.
Okay, great.
2 years.
So, Dr. Tornabene, join memories with me.
Yeah,
I don't recall that we've ever gone 4 months without.
I agree. Yeah, and Annette will talk some more at me fraud, but not only maybe you haven't gone, but
yeah.
This system has been among the worst performing for Clatsy and Connie. So
yeah.
This is a huge achievement for the group.
So
and it would be nice to somehow celebrate them.
Yeah.
Mr. Raskin. Okay. Today we had our monthly operating report for the community hospitals, both Alameda and San Leandro. And if you look at the San Leandro scorecard, it's about 50% to 60% green now. And if you look at the Alameda, it's about 90% green. They only have one or two that aren't red right this month at Alameda. So community hospitals are really coming along.
So trying to model off the article, I'll ask the question, what is our RCA of why we've been successful for 4 months? What is our learning lesson here? And I know Dr. Chen, everyone, Dr. Chen is sitting over there in that corner there. He's our division chief for pulmonary and critical care medicine. His team's probably put in the majority of central lines. Is that true, Dr. Chen?
I'd say we put in a fair number, but the ER is going to be.
Okay. So, but your team ultimately has oversight because they come upstairs to your ICU teams and the like. So do you have any comments, sir, on any of the lessons? Why we could have gone 4 months when neither Dr. Tornabene nor I recall ever going this long before?
Well, I agree with Anna Torres that there's been significant investment in time and effort by hospital administrative staff, the safety team, the quality team, physician champions, really helping to drill down and advocate for these changes. And it's a big culture change. It's, there's a philosophy of, it's hard to put a central line in, so if I put one in, I don't want to take it out.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with Foley catheters. It's easier to leave a Foley catheter in, less mess, less trouble for the staff. And sometimes patients really like it, but it doesn't mean that's the right thing. So it's really changing the way we approach it, understanding that the risks are far outweigh the benefits, and really trying to help people understand that that should be the focus.
That's awesome.
So it's a team effort.
Yes, sir.
Another question.
Yes, sir.
I presented on this data to a healthcare CEO roundtable that I've been involved with for many years. And they really applauded the fact that we look at opportunity groups, social ethnic groups. And one of the things I kind of wondered about is, what do we do with that information? Are we using that as a way to, fast track to progress, so to speak? Or is it merely, at this point, still just statistical?
I think it's an area of opportunity for us. So we're looking at it with the readmissions, but with the other areas, I think it still remains an area of opportunity. We are in an IHI collaborative for equity, and part of it, at this part of the collaborative, is drilling down into that data and figuring out how to use it for performance improvement. And one of our performance improvement managers, Nina, has just joined that team. So we'll be able to incorporate that information or those practices into future PI teams.
Ms. Torres or Dr. Prime, anything else that you would like us to know on this report?
Okay, I'll comment on one thing.
Oh, yes, sir.
Yeah, thank you. Noticing two things on key point number three, 77% of patient retention relations are grievances. And then the next bullet point is 60% of patient relation events are related to ambulatory environment. So I'm kind of putting two and two together. There's a very high number of ambulatory care patients who are reporting grievances. That's the assessment I'm making from that. Is that
access?
Okay.
Yeah.
So a little bit of concern there,
yeah,
being from the ambulatory world myself.
Yeah.
Those are concerning numbers.
Yeah.
And maybe it's more of a comment. Maybe you can talk to me about that a little. I know, is it the ambulatory care? Oh, that's a former FQ person, isn't it? Yes. But maybe you could talk to me, Dr. Tornabene, just so I get an understanding of what we might be doing about that.
Sure. And maybe we were actually just talking about it because access, you know, outpatient access is one of our major operational priorities this year.
Yes.
And indeed, there is a series of initiatives that Dr. Mack, our associate CMO of Ambulatory Services, and then and Terrence Shaw as the CAO are looking at. I mean, and it's everything from just the nuts and bolts of just hiring additional providers to looking at what is a care team, who triages the messages, you know, that come in through an inbox. There's been a pilot or a development of additional roles of advanced practice providers who help both see patients, but also triage inbox messages in some of the clinics. So that is underway. I mean, there's a series of programs that or initiatives that we're looking at really across the enterprise to help support the clinicians at the bedside. And so, and, you know, we'd be happy to come back and actually we're talking about that today, that wanting to come back here to the Quality Committee of the Board and give periodic updates specifically on access and ambulatory, and so that will be coming back.
Well, I would ask the chair to entertain that conversation in the future.
Absolutely.
And agendize that. I would appreciate that. Thank you.
Sure.
One more, scrolling down.
Madam Clerk, would you mind putting the True North Metric dashboard back up?
Yes, will do.
And specifically the second page of the metrics. I have to admit a little surprise on this one because I know how well managed the nursing department is here. And I believe it's Ms. Lofton or Lofgren.
Lofton.
I have been impressed with her since I first met her and her presentations. And then I see patient-centered. I look at this.
Second page. One
second
more
page,
down.
One down, please. You're on right there. That's it. There it is. At the fourth from the bottom. I see this declining number of rate of patients who reported their nurses always communicated well. And I point that out because that's not a clinical issue. That's not a, as Dr. Chen was saying, a procedure. This is really human, right? Old, good old fashioned, just human interaction. And to see that declining, I see 62%. Maybe when I see current month all, I see a 75. Can you explain that 75% under current month all versus 62? What is that telling me? Oh, year to date, I didn't see up above. So year to date, 62. So I see a trend that's going good. If I'm interpreting this correctly, the 75.79 is saying under current month all that.
Current month is 75%. Year to date is 72%.
It's above last year's base.
Yeah, so
oh,
it's
I
above
see.
Last year.
And the rate of 62.4?
That's for that population, the Native American.
Oh, I see, specific to Native Americans.
Yeah.
Which is our biggest opportunity.
Yes, I see. So that's not as far off. I guess I saw a declining number. I focused on the 62%. Okay.
Dr. Mack has your hand up.
Who does?
Yeah, sorry.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Go for it.
I heard the ambulatory, yes. To piggyback on what Dr. Tornabene said, overwhelmingly those grievances are around access. We're very fortunate we've been able to hire quite a bit. Our next challenge is space, but we're getting creative with that. And we're doing more evenings, looking at weekends, as well as televisit and video visits. But I'm happy to bring back to the committee a more comprehensive presentation on what we're doing around access and thus decreasing the grievances.
Thank you, Dr. Mack, because I want to acknowledge how difficult the work is and understand and acknowledge. So no criticism at all. It's just good to keep up on what is happening, what's being done about it. So I'm sure that other trustees and I would appreciate that report back. Appreciate
Absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. All
yeah,
right.
On this point, and yes, I'm good. Trustee Garrett, this is actually already the last item of the evening is the tracking calendar. Dr. Tornabene has already sort of mapped out our year. So we're going to be going through every True North method item. So everyone's going to get highlighted.
Perfect.
Sir.
Oh, when I was looking at this today, I was puzzled by the issue of the grievances contrasted with the dashboard, which has all this green. So if the days are
Ronna, can you scroll up just a touch? Leave it right there.
We're improving on the timeliness. I'm just wondering, the grievances have to do with something more, like the convenience or where the, you know, something like that.
Trustee Stein, and this is just my take, and I'll hear from the pros on this. These are definitely, we're so proud that they're green, but remember this is a specific population. These are return patients. That means they are already in the system. I suspect Dr. Mack can tell us more robustly that the grievances are probably people who can't get in as many.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's a wait list those on the wait list, we were doing much, much better at really all of our sites. There is either no wait list or a manageable number. At Highland, though, we are still greatly impacted, but we are hiring, and Highland in particular is where we're doing more of those sort of alternative hours, as well as, again, increasing our televisits, video visits. But it's absolutely new folks.
I guess my thought was then that this should be something we're measuring in the dashboard.
We have the drill down for that data. It is overwhelmingly wait time for appointments. So we do have that data, but it's dependent on people calling in, right? So someone might not think it's a long wait and might not.
We did have a weighty discussion last year about weighing the news versus returns. And fortunately, trustees, in about 3 months, we're going to have to entertain next year's True North metrics. So we can hold on if this we want this the news maybe and or returns or either way we can put that on our national.
And I can say from my experience working in the health plan world, people's expectations about the availability of services, they want the services they want now.
Yes,
that's
now.
Why they line up at the emergency department.
Yeah,
they don't need to be there.
Absolutely,
people feel that they can't wait. I get that.
Absolutely, sir.
Dr. Mack, just very briefly, two follow-up questions. You might not have these numbers. Do you know what the wait list is? And I know you run multiple ambulatory clinics. Do you have an average time that for primary care?
I absolutely do. Great. I know them by heart. Highland is about 2,000. New patients waiting to be seen.
Patients and time from that they're on the list. The wait time.
So that we are working on. We have those who are actively on the wait list and those who are kind of inactively on the wait list. And the inactive part is those we've reached out to a total of 3 times over 7 business days. So 3 attempts over 7 business days. And we weren't able to reach them. So they're on our wait list, sort of inactive. But we are in a perpetual state of trying to understand who those thousands are on that sort of active or inactive wait list, as well as the active wait list. Got caught off track, sorry. It was 2,000 for Highland, 400 for Hayward, about 100 for Eastmont, and 0 for Newark.
And last question, thank you for that. And I'm looking forward to a deeper discussion later. What, just briefly again, your major barrier, is that staffing, which I completely imagine is at the top of the list or near the top. What would be other issues that you're finding that are causing?
Overwhelmingly staffing. So Greg, before you joined, so our Eastmont clinic, for example, was closed for nearly a year to new patients. We just had some long-term vacancies throughout primary care ambulatory that we fortunately have been able to remedy. Our recruitment team under HR has been doing a fantastic job with recruitment and outreach, going to fairs, reaching out to residency programs. So we've been getting more folks. And then we've been adding to the care teams. So as Dr. Tornabene mentioned, we now have at two of our sites a role for a nurse practitioner to help just with inbox.
Understood.
Dr. Wu has her hand up as well.
Who does Dr. Wu? Dr. Fu. Dr. Patricia Fu. I can't see her.
No,
Dr. Wu. Sorry.
Sorry.
Before we go to Dr. Wu, Dr. Mack, thanks for that data. Quick question. What are the comparable specialty access numbers? So I heard 2,400, 100 at zero. What are the specialty?
Yes. You may know GI is doing better.
We were like 700 for a while.
Yes. Yeah. Right now, probably at the absolute worst is optometry in the thousands. Yeah, so we are hoping with our expansion. With our expansion at Eastmont, that should help quite a bit. We also have optometry at Hayward, so we have South County representation. We're working with our operational partners to make sure all those appointments are utilized and our no-show rate is low for our more impacted specialties. Recently, neurology actually did a sort of mini pilot of a televisit only clinic, televisit, video visit only clinic that was successful. And so, we're hoping maybe to kind of take those learnings and see if we can scale as a way to touch those folks who are on the wait list. And for those specialties that can lend themselves to televisits and video visits.
Do you have an aggregate number for specialty?
Oh, do I have an aggregate? No.
Yeah.
I will get it for you. I don't have it off the top of my head.
Got it. Thank you.
My last comment would be to just reinforce what we discussed earlier is just when you do come back for reporting about telehealth and ideas and concepts you have to expand telehealth services as a means to help with access.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Mack. I know how hard you're working. Appreciate all you're doing.
Thank you.
Sir.
Thank you, everyone. With that, we'll close item D1 and we'll go to item D2. This is the post-acute report from Richard Espinoza, our CAO of post-acute. Madam Clerk, if you'll put Mr. Espinoza's executive summary up for us to peruse for a minute or so. Thank you, Rana. And we'll just leave it here for 30 seconds or so for people to read together. All right, hopefully everyone's had a little bit of time to speed read this. I can't see, is Mr. Espinoza? He's always shows up, so Mr. Espinoza.
Here.
There you go. If you'll touch on whatever you need to touch on, we have 5 minutes left in this agenda item.
Yeah, to Dr. Trustee Sayan's comment earlier, post-acute seems to be a steady driver at the moment and following the rules. I think today we had the our COVID dog medical detection team at Park Ridge was really incredible. That way we're not swabbing patients unnecessarily, but these dogs have been trained as a pilot program, went really well today. And then also our rehab services, in the slides, you can see that of 15 metrics, they surpassed 13. So our throughput with rehab, the teams are really seeing more patients and more treatments by substantial numbers in some cases, by like 30%. And so it's lending to some of the work that we're researching about opening an outpatient clinic at Eastmont and some other work going on. So just very high level things that are happening in post-acute.
Thank you. Trustees, any questions? I mean, I have an obvious question for me for 2.6, but I'm gonna defer to my trustees to go first. Mr. Espinoza, tell us about the COVID sniffing dogs. Yeah. I'm unfamiliar with this. I want sensitivity. I want specific. I mean, where did you learn about this? How did we execute it? How do you forecast this being used? And I don't know anything about this.
So actually, if I could share my screen for one moment, I think that would be great.
While you're doing that, what kind of dogs are they?
They are Labradors. I have Labradors. Here they are. This was today. So I think you recall I sat on the Alameda County Public Health Subject Matter Expert Committee for COVID. And so with that committee, we look at items that are outside of the box. And so one of my colleagues that I work with at the county had mentioned that there was a COVID canine pilot happening with dogs who had been trained to sniff out certain medical issues. And one that they recently been trained on was COVID. And so in the post-acute environment, when you have one positive resident, you have an outbreak. And so in an outbreak, you're testing all staff and all residents every 3 to 4 days to see if you have new cases. And it's not until you have 14 days of no new cases that you are then out of a COVID outbreak. So when you're not in a COVID outbreak, you're not necessarily testing unless you have patients that might have symptoms. The issue with COVID is we know that not all patients have symptoms, but could be positive. And in our environment, since we're a congregate setting, they could be in the dining room or activity room commingling, and then we're spreading. So with this new pilot program, the dogs will come maybe once a week when we're not in an outbreak, and they can sniff around the feet of patients and staff, excuse me, staff and residents, and can identify who, with some really high percentage of accuracy, is positive. And then we follow it with a rapid antigen test. So in the first two photos, you see the dogs at work, sniffing staff. I'm not showing patients, but they were going into the patient rooms. And then in the third picture, you can see where we have a cart that we're following the dogs with our antigen test, so that when they do identify, we back it up with a rapid antigen test just to make sure. And if they're positive, then we're in an outbreak, right? But we were able to get ahead of it and not wait for residents to have symptoms because we can identify patients who may be asymptomatic. A great program. Today was the first day. They went through the staff. No positives today, knock on wood. And so Scarlett and Rizzo, the two dogs, after they work, then you're allowed to pet them. And so it also is followed up with like some pet therapy, which is great for the residents.
Amazing. Mr. Espinoza, you know, amazing as always. A couple questions. How long does this pilot cost to the system, et cetera?
It's my favorite cost, which is
zero.
Free. It's free. And so we're going to see how long we can work with them, how long they're going to be utilizing the dogs. But for as long as the pilot exists, we're looking to do it once a week in our buildings. Fairmont just closed their outbreak today. So they will be the next building to utilize non-outbreak. And it doesn't cost the SNFs any money, which is great.
Wow. I have to ask, how reliable is this?
Yeah, so the dogs are very reliable. They have a really good accuracy from the data that we learned. The one thing that we're trying to identify and trying to get more clarity that if you're a COVID recovered, right? So if you've had the 10 days, no symptoms, you've no more fever, according to CMS, you can close the case after 10 days. We're trying to understand, do they still identify those patients? But we have records of who was positive and when they were last positive. So what we're going to see if there's any correlation to what length of time do they still identify. So that's something that we're looking at.
Great work, Mr. Espinoza.
Can you remind us, again, the definition of outbreak? How many patients over what period of time, at what point you're considered in outbreak mode?
Yeah, one positive resident patient is an outbreak. And three positive employees is considered an outbreak. And then you must test every 3 to 4 days, the entire building and all the staff of the building, all shifts, until you have 14 days of no new positives, then they will clear you.
Thank you.
Yep.
Richard, Mr. Espinoza, thank you for that report. Thank you to the quality team. With that, we'll close out item D. We'll go into item E. This is one of our two marquee presentations tonight. It's called Up-to-Date Preventative Health Screenings. Everyone should know that this is actually one of our true North Metric quality items. Leading us in will be Dr. Natalie Curtis. Dr. Curtis is an awesome internist here in our system, and she's also the medical director of value-based care. And she's going to be sort of leading us in. Dr. Curtis, we're going to read your executive summary together, and then I'm going to give it to you in about a minute or two. So welcome. Madam Clerk, will you put up Dr. Curtis's executive summary? Can you shrink that down maybe 100%? Thank you. Rhonda, can you scroll down just a little bit to halfway? Thank you. Yeah, I'll leave it right there. And then how about all the way to the bottom? Thank you. Trustees, you good? Good evening, Dr. Curtis. And Rana, we can give Dr. Curtis the screen.
Good evening. Can everyone hear me okay?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, welcome. Wonderful. Thank you so much, Trustee Bouquet.
We have 15 to 20 allocated for this, okay?
Oh, okay, great. Well, then I will take my time. And thank you to the board for inviting me here to talk about this metric. So I'm going to do a deep dive on adult health maintenance up to date. We already got a preview of kind of where it stands now, but I'm going to take you through how it's projected to actually do better and kind of what the metric means. So just to give you a summary of the points that I'm going to go through tonight, first up, adult health maintenance up to date is a custom composite measure of AHS's preventative care for adults. And we'll get into a little bit about why kind of we decided to choose this as a metric. We also have been in the process of doing metric revisions. That there were a number of reasons that, you know, made it so that we considered doing this and are going to do this moving forward for the rest of the year. And from these changes, the performance is actually expected to improve. And as you saw kind of in the dashboard from January, like the improvements are expected to be seen and reflected in the dashboard of February 2024. And then in addition to kind of the nitty-gritty about the metrics, there is a vast kind of variety of different strategies that we're using to drive metric performance, because it is a complex metric, so it has to be kind of multifaceted in its approach. So what is oral health maintenance up to date? So just to kind of take a step back, so kind of in prior iterations of the True North dashboard, we wanted to kind of find a way to capture all of the incredible quality work that folks in ambulatory are doing. Many of you may know we are part of the Quality Incentive Program, which is a program that is worth $70 million of allocated funds to the system that we're kind of banking on getting. And so in order to get this money, we really need to achieve these metric targets that are set forth by the state. And so given all the work that's being done on that, we really wanted to find a metric that captured that sort of work. But we also wanted to use a metric that folks kind of wrap their head around. I mean, we hate to throw out the topic of like QIP acronyms, you know, are the worst. We really wanted to try and find an idea that folks recognize. That's like, this is something that we know that we're all like, we're all on the same page with what we're talking about. Previously, we were looking at percent of QIP metrics kind of met, but we really wanted something that was kind of more of an idea that that made sense. And so with that, what we tried to think about is taking the ideas and the, you know, the spirit behind, you know, QIP and really thinking about kind of clinical quality metrics related to ambulatory and using kind of preventative health screenings, preventative health care services, and kind of the ones that are due amongst our patient populations and kind of what fraction of those preventative health care studies have been completed by our patients as the metric. And so this is comprised of, we've listed out here just kind of all the different metrics, but as you can see, there are many. So just kind of ranging from cancer screening or breast cancer screening, colon cancer screening and cervical cancer screening, infectious disease screening with HIV and chlamydia, and then behavioral health topics of like tobacco screening, counseling, depression screening and follow-up. You can see there's an asterisk by a number of these metrics. These asterisks reflect measures that are also HEDIS metrics. So kind of thinking about, again, aligning for kind of national standards, national benchmarks in terms of clinical quality metrics. The last measure on there is also rate of influenza vaccine, which is kind of a distinct kind of topic area, which we're going to get kind of into a little bit more about kind of what we thought about that as a fraction of this metric. So for the changes, so, you know, in order to kind of ensure that we've got mapping kind of logic that is the same amongst all of our metrics, we kind of follow specifications based out of the Quality Incentive Program, which releases, you know, a metric manual every year. And just based upon various changes that have happened from specialty societies, USPSTF recommendations, at times these metrics change, like they're dynamic, things are not the same always. And so there are a couple of things that have changed since the first iterations of the True North metric dashboard and the logic for it. The first one was colorectal cancer screening. When we first started the metric, screening age was 50. And then kind of, you know, in the recent kind of year or two, that initiation of cancer screening started at 45, thus changing like the entire denominator of the metric and changing the metric logic. In addition to that, depression screening and follow-up, we were not following kind of standardized practices that many of our healthcare system partners kind of were using as targets, and our target differed from that. So we really wanted to kind of follow best practice, again, of other kind of sister organizations and have it match that and align with kind of best practice models for depression screening and follow-up thresholds. We mentioned influenza and kind of how it was like a last metric, kind of hard to group in the other. And so influenza vaccine is an incredibly important metric, but kind of as we're wrapping our head around kind of prediction and kind of driving improvement work for the metric, influenza vaccine was kind of a discordant with that, because influenza vaccination is kind of a peculiar metric because it doesn't follow a year. It's a seasonal thing. And so unlike all the other metrics that are in the composite that really, it's like it's always ongoing improvement. You know, every month we can drive improvement on cancer screening, on infectious disease screening. However, influenza vaccine kind of levels out, and there's not much we can do to drive any sort of improvement once the flu season has closed. Furthermore, like the alignment of kind of when the metric timing happens doesn't align perfectly with fiscal reporting either. So therefore, we decided that, especially in terms of making this metric more intuitive, that we would pull it out. That being said, you know, the influenza vaccination is incredibly important. And so there will be ongoing monitoring. This is also a metric that we're responsible for in the quality incentive program. And then there are other venues in which influenza vaccination rates are being monitored, for example, kind of employee health vaccines as well. So this is just kind of a summary of the changes that are being made, just to kind of see in more detail. So the ones that are highlighted are the changes. So again, the colon cancer screening age has been changed to 45 to 74. Depression screening and follow-up requirement for follow-up is changed, and then we're removing the influenza immunization metric. So how is this going to change things? So this is a preview of things to come. We saw it before that our metric was in red, but we do anticipate that that performance will improve. So this is a snapshot on the left of our performance rates kind of pre being the first line in November. So this was what was visible on the True North metric dashboard for November. And then the post of the same, taking the same month and just kind of changing the logic to adjust the things that we've mentioned before. And we can see that metric performance does improve in quite significantly. And so with that sort of significant change, we wanted to kind of pause and reflect and make sure we really understood what the driver was for the increase in performance. And so one of the things that you may note is that the DC, which stands for the denominator of the metric, has diminished significantly. And we think that that's kind of one of the major drivers. Influenza vaccination is agnostic of age, you know, sex, you know, those sorts of characteristics. And therefore, there were many, many, many more people that would only be in the flu denominator versus other kind of healthcare screening tests that have more of a limited age characteristics. And then the behavioral health kind of follow-up, given that we changed the thresholds, we are actually have higher kind of compliance with the follow-up. And that was another driver in terms of, we suspect, in terms of the metric performance improving. This is just another snapshot of that. So again, this is kind of similar to the dashboard that we saw earlier today. This is January's performance, January's dashboard with kind of the December preliminary. And then this is just kind of looking at the February dashboard preliminary that came out. And we can see that this is now in the green with the baseline and targets changing based upon the new metric logic. And with those changes, we are now in the green. So just to kind of, again, like with a composite metric, it's kind of, we want to, again, kind of reevaluate and make sure kind of, does this make sense with all the components, especially, you know, with it kind of improving in performance. So, you know, what I wanted to do is take a moment to kind of give you a snapshot of all of the different composites that kind of make up this metric, just to kind of show that, because I mean, we would predict that with that sort of global improvement, like all of our other metrics kind of in that denominator should really reflect that improvement. And so this is in a collection of four of the metrics that shows you performance over time with the different color lines corresponding to our each of our primary care clinics, and the black line being AHS's performance overall, and the hash kind of line being specific targets. And we can see kind of overall the general trajectory of the AHS line is improving over time. Just as a note, but kind of not a slide here, but as an aside, we are also taking all of these metrics, and we do stratify these data too by race and ethnicity, also as part of our constant evaluation of the metric performance to make sure that we're capturing and understanding any disparities that may exist in the metric performance. So what are we doing? What are some of the things that we kind of are working towards in terms of driving improvement? Like, we've been very pleased to see the kind of this continual improvement in a lot of our metrics. They're varied. They traverse many different practice settings. And so we have lots of different strategies, kind of the first one being interdepartmental collaboration, which has been a big kind of aspect of, you know, this last year and kind of moving into 2024, specifically with breast cancer screening. You know, really, we have, this is one of our, I think, our strongest kind of working groups for metrics in which we've got a very strong collaboration between our colleagues in the Department of Radiology, in primary care, and in kind of value-based care, really kind of working collaboratively to drive improvement, lowering barriers to access. So we especially know that one of the drivers, you know, to kind of some of the disparities that we see is just kind of like difficulty with access and kind of populations that have been kind of, there have been disparities in are kind of some of the patients that are patients that have kind of ongoing substance use. And we've seen that the Bridge Clinic has been an amazing asset to HS in terms of really kind of accessing, linking those folks to care. And so part of the next step to that is like knowing that Bridge is a low barrier, you know, practice setting. How can we bring preventative healthcare screenings to them? You know, because that's kind of more, it's kind of care on your terms, essentially. So let's bring kind of preventative health screenings to them instead of having them kind of come into the classic primary care model. Uplifting patient voice is another strategy that we've been looking at. You know, we always try to kind of incorporate patient surveys in terms of really understanding the root causes of why metrics are not, you know, achieving the goal. And then in 2024, we're really looking towards kind of doing the next step with the Pfizer Cancer Collaborative work and building community co-design into our improvement strategies for cancer screening, specifically around like colorectal cancer screening rates, breast cancer screening rates, and cervical cancer screening rates. So we're very excited about that. And then the last kind of bucket being really important, I think of like technology and outreach. So really like 2023 was the first step of trying to do like MyChart outreach, MyChart direct scheduling for preventative health care services. And then also just kind of increasing our rate of texting patients. We've learned that our patients are not bothered by our texting. So we just kind of go out. We know that it's a very successful and effective outreach strategy. So here's a couple of like more points in terms of our priorities for 2024. We know that one of the big drivers for us not being able to achieve our goal on metrics is those patients who are assigned to us, so kind of our responsibility for care, but not accessing traditional healthcare services. And so thinking about, we've heard about kind of the primary care access difficulties, but it's still really important to get those folks connected with preventative health services. So really thinking about what are non-traditional pathways for getting folks into screening for that. Talked a little about community collaboration and co-design. Another thing that we've learned a lot is like, we've got a really wonderful, robust system of data and analytics for our quality metrics of performance, but then how can we generalize that to clinical operations, which are really important in terms of allowing folks at the clinic side to like really, you know, reinforce the work that's happening on a day-to-day basis. And then lowering barriers to data. You know we can engage providers much better if the data is in Epic in the system that they use. And unfortunately, in current state, a lot of our quality data lives outside of Epic and other dashboards. So I'm going to pause here. Thank you so much. I'm happy to answer any questions that folks may have. I know there's like a lot of different kind of topics there.
Dr. Curtis, that was a great walkthrough. Thank you for that. Helps us to understand that metric better. I'm going to open up to my trustees for questions. I just have a kind of a threshold question that when I was reviewing this, it wasn't clear to me today. What we're talking about here is the performance and adjustments that are being made in the targets that we use to measure ourselves, right? And what I'm wondering about is, where are we with respect to the hard targets that we don't set, whether it's, you know, the state or, you know, QIP, these programs that we're trying to meet? Those are fixed for everyone, right? We don't get to decide those. And I'm not seeing that here. I'm wondering, where are we with respect to those external expectations?
Yeah, it's a really great question. I think, you know, and this being such a complex metric where the benchmark is and the targets are really based and weighted based upon the metric and the metric denominators, it's kind of a hard kind of thing to determine, like, what is the 90th percentile kind of for that. But in a number of our for every metric, we are ultimately striving towards 90th percentile, 100%. And then for those that are achieving performance at 90th percentile, like the priority becomes to ensure there's no disparity in metric performance as well. For our metrics that are at the 90th percentile, we typically have like the metrics that are mostly in the 90th percentile target are kind of our pediatric metrics. A large number of those tend to be at the 90th percentile already. We have a couple adult kind of medicine type metrics that are already at 90th percentile. So some of them, if we looked at the metric performance over time, you'd see that it looks kind of static because it kind of is hitting the 90th percentile, which would be chlamydia screening is one of the ones that I can think of off the top of my head where we're at the 90th percentile. But I think that's a really great point in terms of like, if we've already kind of it's like setting kind of a metric target, and then is there like kind of a super target that we can set and like know kind of where 90th percentile is? I wonder, that is definitely a good, that is like a great thought and important. And we do that with our individual dashboards, the kind of those snapshots that I showed, and I can show them again for every metric when we're kind of driving improvement. If the target line is not 90th percentile, we are kind of holding ourselves to 90th percentile. And these benchmarks kind of are determined based upon, you know, national standards. I don't know if that answered your question. I apologize if it didn't.
I think to get a little cleaner, you talked about the incentive that's available in this program. I want to know, are we getting it? Mm-hmm. Are we meeting what we need to get that?
Oh yeah. So the difference between the QIP, the Quality Incentive Program, versus the True North metric dashboard and timing is that QIP is on a calendar year. So we have already concluded our performance year for 2023, and kind of through our performance, looking back at all of 2023, we achieved kind of the vast majority of our metric targets, and through overperformance and various other kind of things, we anticipate to get 100% of the allocated funds from last year. So now with January 1, we are starting over. And so that's when those sorts of benchmarks get redetermined, and we're continually expected to kind of drive improvement towards either like closing the gap to the 90th percentile or sustaining the 90th percentile if we're already there.
Sir, that was my question. Thank you, Dr. Curtis. That was my question.
Dr. Curtis, thank you for that walkthrough. That was really illuminating. Any other comments?
Just briefly, Dr. Curtis, I missed it. Who changed the denominator and varied the population criteria? Was that the health plan? Was that HEDIS nationally? Was that internal?
This was an internal decision, and the decision was based on the fact of kind of just specifically the denominator change specifically related to the influenza metric being pulled out of the composite.
Dr. Curtis, can you put up your slide one more time, which had the individual breast cancer, colon cancer, et cetera, by time?
Of course.
And I think this would sort of be an interesting one for us. I have a particular interest in one of these, the bottom left, the colorectal cancer screening.
Yeah.
And I think context is important. In 2011, when I started developing our colorectal cancer screening program, we were sporadic at that time, we had an 18% colorectal cancer screening rate. And just seeing where we are, so the scale here is only a few months. I'd ask you to consider looking back into historic data and maybe charting that against time. I think that would be a really illustrative slide on the journey that we've made. I mean, we have effectively, you know, tripled our colorectal cancer screening rates over the past decade or so. And I think that story, that, you know, this one, it's moving a little bit, but that story I find to be extraordinarily compelling. So just consider that maybe for some future presentations.
Yeah, thank you so much. And yeah, this, I think we've seen incredible improvement over time with many of these metrics, which has been really, really great, especially having this infrastructure to do so.
Dr. Curtis, if you could scroll up two or maybe three slides to the definition change slide.
Yeah.
Maybe I could ask my question again with this slide up. So maybe I was thinking the slide above where it has the
one?
Yes. Thank you. The colorectal cancer screening, I believe you said that metric changed from 50 to 45?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. What drove that change?
So that was changed based on kind of two reasons. One is just USPSTF, U.S. Preventive Health Services Task Force changed the guidelines for colorectal cancer screening, and best practices now is to start colorectal cancer screening at age 45. And the metric logic for the quality incentive program metric on colorectal cancer screening lagged a bit because with kind of these state programs, sometimes the changes to, you know, national guidelines aren't immediate because it's a big program. And so I think last year, 2023 was the year that the screening age and the definition of that metric changed. And so given that we were using that metric definition, and also because it's best practice in terms of, you know, the population who we should be screening for colorectal cancer, we changed the metric.
Perfect. Thank you.
Thank
yeah.
you. Dr. Curtis, once again, thank you very much. With that, we're going to close out item E. We're going to go to item F, the last kind of marquee presentation. This is on our CMS star rating and kind of leapfrog assessments. Madam Clerk, can you bring up the executive summary on this? And of course, we have Dr. Tornabene, our Chief Medical Officer, and Annette Johnson, our Director of Quality Analytics and PI, who are sort of going to lead us into this. We are at 6:24, Madam CMO. If you can nicely lead us through this in 6 to 8 minutes, that would be cool.
We'll do it quickly.
Do you want slides? Everyone, speed read here. This is sort of our a preview of what we're going to see, and then I'll give you your slides.
Yeah.
Okay, let's let them slide it up.
Great. Well, we're pulling up that presentation. I'll just jump into the brief intro, and then. And then Annette will take us through the detail. And I just wanted to kind of remind the audience here around these two programs. One is our LeapFrog score, and then the other is our CMS star rating. So the LeapFrog score is based on an aggregate score that's a letter grade from the LeapFrog group, which takes publicly reported metrics, but also gives us a grade based on surveys that we fill out and send to the LeapFrog group twice a year. And there is over 20 measures in the LeapFrog survey in categories, in the following categories: preventable errors, injuries, infections, and then importantly, which is something that I like about the LeapFrog survey, is what systems do we have in place to prevent the harms and injuries. So there's a lot of questions around what are our systems of care, and we adjust our you know approaches based on some of these questions. And then in addition, you know, the CMS star rating, we're talking about the hospital star rating here, not the post-acute one. And these are the questions that this is a program that's likely, you know, obviously well known to all of us here, which is supposed to provide objective information for essentially Medicare recipients and consumers of healthcare. And there are five measure groups in the star rating, which is the mortality, safety of care, readmissions, patient experience, and timely and effective care. And so there's a series of metrics in these different categories. And so with that, we wanted to provide this update to our quality committee of the board about how we're doing and also what we're trying to do in order to improve our score. So with that, and that's gonna take us through first LeapFrog and then our CMS star rating. So Annette, go ahead.
Okay. Great, thanks. So this is our LeapFrog scoring. As Dr. Tornabene mentioned before, there are three buckets of metrics when we look at LeapFrog. There is the sort of structural measures, like do you have certain safety practices in place? There is patient experience, and then there is harms. And so when we take a look at our current grade, we can see that we are a C at Alameda in Highland and a B at San Leandro. If we do not make improvements to our structural or safety measures, when we resubmit our grades and our fall grade for 2024 comes out, our hospitals will all drop to a C. However, if we are able to implement the structural measures, we will actually be able to push Alameda to an A. Highland will come very, very close to a B and fall just below it, unfortunately, and San Leandro will maybe be able to maintain their B. This is based on a couple of assumptions that we are not going to see dramatic additions or changes to the survey, and that there's not going to be performance shifts across the industry, which there hasn't been historically. The one thing I do want to point out is there was a big lag time for the actual outcome metrics like patient experience and harm. They lag behind by more than a year. So like the performance period for those are already closed, even though we haven't even submitted the survey yet. So the only thing we can drive right now is those structural measures. So we're taking a look at all of the structural measures that we don't have in place. And you can see outlined in this table, I won't bore you with all of the details, that we have plans underway to address each one of those so that we can meet that goal of getting these safety structural measures in place. Moving forward, there's only one where we're pursuing partial net, and that's due to with the physician staffing in the ICU. Because our volume doesn't justify in our community hospitals sort of what LeapFrog recommends. I do want to show you, this is actually, if you're interested in the details of LeapFrog scoring, these are our scorecards. This is our current scorecard. This is our projected scorecard from left to right. If you take a look, one of the things I think that's insightful is Highland and San Leandro share a license. So all of our structural measures and all of our patient experience metrics are exactly the same across those two campuses. And yet San Leandro is on the path to get a B. And that has a lot to do with their harm performance, their ability to reduce harm. So it really highlights that the main opportunity for Highland is the fact that we need to bring down our harm rates, which we have been doing in this year. And we hope to see in our fall 2025 grade. Improve our performance in our fall 2025 grade. So I'm going to move into our star rating. So star rating uses many of the same metrics that LeapFrog does, but it adds in additional mortality, readmissions, and timeliness and effectiveness of care. So this is ED throughput. You can see that our Alameda Hospital has up to 4 stars, and unfortunately Highland is at 1 star. So you can see when we look at Alameda, Highland, and San Leandro, everybody has an opportunity with improving patient experience. And then when we look at Highland and San Leandro, it is our safety of care, again, that harm rates over at Highland, and then readmissions. And the reason we see readmissions here is because we have such a low population of Medicare patients at Highland, and when we do, they tend to be much more sick. So this unfortunately biases our readmission results here. So you can see there's crossover with this between LeapFrog and star rating, again, patient experience and hospital acquired infections. So to really improve, we need to focus on getting our HAIs at Alameda to 0 for, so no hospital acquired infections in 12 months. Our current opportunity is C. difficile here. We do, and the big bucket again, as mentioned before, is patient experience. As 4 out of 5 domains are below the national average. The one area that we're performing really well is our doctor communication. When we look at Highland, 4 out of 5 HAIs are above the mean. Like I said before, in this new year, we've seen improvement in CLABSI and CAUTI and SSI, but our current opportunities are C. difficile and CAUTI. And again, an opportunity to improve patient experience. And then for San Leandro, very similar to Alameda in that the opportunity when we talk about harms is C. difficile. So to that end, we have, if you've ever gotten to speak with Dr. Angela Ng, our Director of Patient Experience, she has a very robust plan to address patient experience, and we're starting to see those numbers rise in this fiscal year. We have, we're really working on service training, whether that's a standardized communication model such as GIFT, as well as hourly rounding and nurse leader rounding, no pass zones, and really working to teach the staff how to connect with their patients, whether that is via simulation and practicing in a sim lab, to getting feedback when the nurses round or the nurse leaders round on the unit.
Level 3 trauma alert, ECA, 8 minutes.
So then when we take a look at our hospital acquired infections at Highland, again, is CAUTI, CLABSI, and SSI, based off of the performance from 2 years ago. We have, again, launched CAUTI, CLABSI, SSI, and C. difficile team team. So our current performance is significantly better than it was at the time that this data snapshot was taken for this score. And we're really doing this by our infection control team is amazing. They're out there doing daily audits and giving feedback, not only on the outcome metrics, but the process metrics. So how are we doing on maintaining our lines and keeping them sterile? What is the device necessity? And then our nursing and our physician staff have been really, really engaged in looking at device necessity and removing those lines when they're not needed. So we've seen a significant improvement. We have also launched a Scrub the Hub campaign specifically focused on continuing the improvement that we're seeing in our central line infections. We're focusing on the best practices to really continue to drive down those the opportunity for harm. And every HAI, our infection control team, partners with the physicians and nurses involved in any given HAI event and does a mini root cause. And those learnings are shared not only with our performance improvement teams, but in our MORs and as well as at our safety campus safety huddles that occur so that everyone is learning from this opportunity. We're not waiting for these events to happen on each unit before providing that education. And then we're continuing to work. Our newest thing that we're working on is culture ordering and timing practices to really help make sure that we're not creating an opportunity where a community acquired infection is being labeled as a hospital acquired infection. So we continue to work on driving those down. That brings me to the end of my presentation. If you wanted to see how these different metrics break down, this is just a sort of summary slide of how what each of these metrics weigh in the overall scoring system for these two quality reporting programs.
Thank you, Ms. Johnson. Trustees, any questions for Dr. Tornavene or Ms. Johnson on this report?
No.
Sir, I'm going to ask a really granular question. Something that came up in Alameda is one of our physicians had this concern that tests had to be ordered. We were requiring tests to be ordered in Epic, but community physicians sent people to Alameda Hospital to get an X-ray or something like that. And this physician, historically, they could just bring in a piece of paper. Prescription, right. And I'm wondering, does this shortfall of 30% here represent those situations, which I gather has been turned back on and they could do that again? Because we were sort of losing business, so to speak. Is that why we're at 70 in Alameda and 100 everywhere else? The very first item on the before
computerized.
Oh no, I see. We're at 100 on the road. Yeah, is that why it went from 70 to 100? And are we going back on it?
There we go.
No. So what this does is, unfortunately, Leapfrog requires us sends us a bunch of scenarios, and then we have physicians enter them into a test system, and they're testing our physician order entry process to see if it alerts for errors or mistakes in ordering, and then if the physicians catch it. So it's their way of testing to see how robust and safe our physician order entry process is.
God, never thought that. Thank you.
I thought it was good.
What's your confidence level in your projections for post implementation?
Pretty good. I do think that we're on the right path. We have been seeing steady improvement in our Leapfrog scores for the last couple of years.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you for that report. That's very illuminating again. So with that, we'll close out item F. Before I go into item G, we're almost there. I apologize, Dr. Andrea Wu had her hand up and then I didn't see her, so I blew her off. Dr. Wu, you had a comment before.
Thanks, yeah. I really was trying to, you know, as we're sort of getting these presentations on the various quality initiatives and how standard of care is really sort of becoming higher and higher. It really occurred to me that as an organization that we really need to strategize where we wanna focus our attention and our investments. And this kind of ties to the article you had mentioned before in the beginning of like, where do we put our limited resources to focus on these quality improvement efforts? And a lot of this does require investments in physicians, investments in nurses, and you know, trying to address for staffing shortages, et cetera. And so, it's something that, you know, we're seeing in two different conversations, I think. You know, we're seeing a quality discussion here on star ratings and meeting QIP metrics, But at the same time, I think, you know, in other discussions, we're talking about the finances of our organization. And I want to acknowledge that Mr. Jackson mentioned not having a scarcity mindset. So, you know, I think that we're all striving to do that too, knowing that we do live in a place where we have to sort of prioritize our resources. And so it was just sort of highlighting to me that, like, to do quality, we still need to invest. And sometimes that is expensive.
Great comment. Thank you, Dr. Wu. Let's go into item G. Madam Clerk, if you'll put up the planning calendar and the issue tracking, I just want to kind of remind everyone, Dr. Tornabene has put mind to a Word document and has sort of given us a forecast, which looks pretty good. Like everything, these are living documents. We can evolve them. What you see here is sort of a cadence, or a forecasted cadence for hearing our True North metric items. Trustees, there are still open spots. This is a living document. We can move these things. But I'll ask if you have anything that you have on your list that you would like to hear about. And I'll just start off with two, if that's okay.
Please.
One, Madam CMO, usually in May, we hit a presentation on the forecast of True North metrics.
Correct.
Because we have to vote in June. So let's put that, if you don't mind, in May. We have a TBD.
Yeah.
We can use that to hear about what quality we would like to propose for True North metrics. A second one that I would propose, we heard this maybe 2 years ago, 18 months ago, an update on foreign language use in our translation service. I always find that to be sort of a fascinating thing. How we do it, what percent of our patients don't speak English, and how that might be impactful. That's not a hurry item, but it's something that I always like to hear about because I live it every day. This morning, I did a full roster of endoscopy, and probably 65% of my patients didn't speak English.
Wow.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, trustees, anything else you'd like to add to this?
I assume that the June presentation is when we'll hear back about, I don't know, I'm sorry, the acronym TNA.
Third next
available appointment.
Yeah.
Yes. So would that be where we're going to hear from the ambulatory care?
Exactly. So in May, we wanted to separate out the access for primary care and specialty care into two different presentations.
I see.
So May will be about primary care, and then June will be on specialty care.
Okay.
But these are both about the return, not about the.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, and that is just because of we put the title of the existing TNN metric in there,
right.
But we would of course want to not just focus on the return, but the new patient as well. An in-depth presentation,
inclusive of reporting on something to do with telehealth.
Correct.
Okay. Very
yeah.
good.
Yeah, one of the things that struck me tonight is that we're doing a good and better job of screening for the people that are our active patients. But there's all those people out there that can't get appointments or are waiting to get appointments or don't call us back. And from sort of public health perspective, we have no idea what the screening is for those people, you know, and they're a pretty important demographic because they raised their hand and said they needed some kind of medical care, and, you know, but then they fall away because that's what people do. They get better and maybe or whatever, they just stop trying. To be able to reach more of those people.
Thank you. And where would we see anything to do with maternal and child health?
We currently
are those may not be True North metrics,
but it doesn't mean we don't talk about it. So, sir, this is the point where you get to say, I think I would like to hear about this.
I think I would like to hear about maternal and child health. I just with the us serving a very large African American population, the low birth weights, the maternal and child death rates, it's just something that I personally, as a public health professional, have to see and understand what we're doing about that. So
it makes perfect sense if you might be able to round out that request. Either you don't have to go, you can send that directly to our CMO about what you would like in that presentation form. You've already given a little, but if you can form that, that'll give her better guidance to guide her to you.
And we can either do it together in one presentation on maternal and then child, or we can separate that into two different.
See, so many options.
Yeah, so we can continue to have that on.
Let's continue that.
And Dr. Lee, you know, of course, our chief of staff.
Oh, sorry, and with Dr. Lee, who is in our
OMG. We actually, in our department meeting today, had an excellent report about our, and Dr. Kelly just left.
Yes, yeah. I know. I saw her walk out right when I was about to say that. So.
About Beloved and Albert
yes.
Lee Collaborative.
Yes.
And so they're actually doing a lot of data collection about women who are overall, all women that are delivering on FBC.
Yes, for all women.
I think that some of that data, some of that presentation would be great to bring to
So, sir, may I give you that charge to connect with our CMO?
Of course.
Our chief of staff.
Yes.
And Dr. Kelly,
I met her earlier. Thank you, Jeanette. She introduced me, so I met her earlier, and I'll be happy to follow up.
Is that acceptable?
Yeah, certainly.
Okay.
Certainly. Thank you both.
Okay. Well, that will close item G, and I apologize. I'm plus 13 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
That ends our open session. Council, sir.
Thank you, Chair Bouquet. The Quality Committee of the Board will now go into closed session to consider the items stated on the agenda.
Thank you. Audience, we're anticipating this will only be about 15 minutes, but we probably won't have anything to report back. So have the gift of time. Have a good evening. Everyone, we're back from closed. Council?
Thank you, Chair Bouquet. The Quality Committee of the Board met in closed session and approved the medical staff reports. There were no other reportable actions taken.
Thank you, Council. With that, we'll close the February 28, 2024 Quality Committee of the Board. Everyone have a great evening.